We are continuing today in this series of Come and See, and it's really an invitation to come here once again, or perhaps for the first time or in a fresh way, who Jesus is, what he's all about. We can build a lot of theology onto who Jesus was. We can build a lot of religious practice onto who Jesus was. Sometimes it's helpful to just return to his words and his actions and consider him in a fresh way. And I think that's a particularly pertinent statement this morning. We're going to see that in two different stories, he encounters well-intentioned and good religious practices, and he pours himself into the middle of those, or inserts himself into it, to bring a fresh experience of God. This morning, these two stories, the wedding and the temple cleansing, I want to just briefly talk about each one and then try to make an application from them together. I have preached on both of these stories separately before, but I've never put them together. But here they are in the same chapter in John, and deciding to do that this morning, I saw some different things that I hadn't seen before, so I'm excited to share that with you. We're going to start in the first half of this chapter with a wedding. This may well be familiar to you, and I'll remind you, this is at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. This is actually recorded as his first miracle, at least his first public miracle. And in brief, the story goes like this. Jesus was invited to the wedding and wedding reception of someone he knew. We talked this morning in confirmation about who's invited to a wedding, and they said friends and family, and we agreed you don't really invite strangers to your wedding. It is most likely that Jesus and Mary, his mother, and apparently even his disciples, they all knew this bride and groom and the families. And at this point, there were probably only four or five disciples. This is still early on. He's met the fishermen. And so they're all at this wedding. And you may remember the story. Probably a very typical Middle Eastern wedding went on for days and days. And at some point, they ran out of wine, and that would have been a big deal, just like it would be today if you were hosting a wedding and you ran out of food or drink. I kind of polled the confirmation class on if they had been to a wedding reception before, what they remembered, and we heard food. It was at the top of the list, and music and dancing and people and friends and some games. If you ran out of food, that's one of the centerpieces of a reception, and certainly wine was probably the only thing drunk at a wedding reception, and they ran out. It would be an embarrassment, a disappointment, might have ended the party early. And in what is a pretty mysterious exchange, Jesus' mother turns to him and says, "They're out of wine." I mean, no, we don't get the explanation of, "Hey, like you did, you know, when you were a kid and we ran out of, maple syrup at the table, could you just do a little fill up?" We don't know if she just meant, "Hey, son, go to the store, help him out." We don't know. And there's so many questions. You know, we don't get all the stories of what was Jesus like as a child or teenager or young adult. Was he at home doing miracles left and right so that his mother might well expect him to do something miraculous? Was it just a matter of let's help our friends out? But we do get this clue. Jesus' response to her is, "My time has not yet come." We talked in confirmation class about like if your mom had gone to the store and was bringing in the groceries and one bag was left in the car, and she said to you, confirmation student, "Hey, will you go get that last bag in the car?" It would not be a very helpful or appropriate response to say, "My time has not yet come." So likewise, that's probably not what Jesus meant. Like, "I don't want to do that." It hints at there is very much the potential to do something miraculous. Mary knows that. Jesus knows that. And he is aware of and maybe even has thoughts towards when is the right time to go public with this ministry and this news that the Messiah has come. I mean, all that, we don't get it spelled out here, but with that, "My time has not yet come," there is a timing that is in his mind. And yet his mother then turns to the servants as if to leave it in his hands and says, "Just do whatever he tells you to do." Again, there's so much more I would love to know about the background, but that's all we get. And Jesus then tells the servants to go fill up these huge water pots with water. And again, without a whole lot of arm waving or special words or puff of smoke, they fill them with water, and then he just says, "Well, go take some to the head waiter." And they do, and that person tastes it, and it's the best wine he's ever tasted. Why in the world did you not serve this up front? Where did this come from, the special reserve? Again, I want so many more details about what happened. When did the change happen? How did Jesus make that happen? We don't get any of that. And I think, upon reflection, that's probably not the point of the story. I think the point is, and we were told in chapter 1 that Jesus, we heard a number of words to help us understand who he was. He's the Word, he's the life, he's the light. He's come to show us the glory of God, to explain God to us. And I'm reminded of that word life, right? He is a party that was about to die. He, by this miraculous action, brought life to the party. I mean, literally, he was the life of the party. He brings goodness and life, and it's good. It's not just mediocre, it's good. I think that's the kind of the main thing going there. And he's decided to go public, right? The word's going to spread. But there is in here, tucked away in this story, and this is why I chose the picture of the water pots, there is a detail that is also important that ties it to the next story that I want to mention. These water pots, we're told they're huge. They hold 20 to 30 gallons of water. A smaller person could probably fit inside one of those. Massive, right? And there's six of them. And this is going to become the wine supply for the wedding. We calculated in class this morning 150 to 100 gallons of great wine. But did you catch in there what they're used for? These were water pots for ceremonial. They were ceremonial water pots used for washing, for purifying, for cleansing. They weren't for drinking. The closest analog I can think of for us would be the baptismal font right here. Certainly not 20 gallons worth. But imagine, and again I suggested to Zach, this was not a good idea. What if they were having youth dinner and he couldn't find a pitcher in the kitchen, so he came and filled up the baptismal font with water to serve the kids out of it. I said, not a good move. Don't do that. That's a little bit of the dynamic going on there. These ceremonial pots were used in relation to the kosher rules and the Mosaic law, and they had a purpose and a religious purpose. You didn't drink out of them. You certainly didn't serve out of them. They were for a God-ordained religious purpose. And yet Jesus is the same Jesus who said, I didn't come to do away with that law at all, but to explain it, to fulfill it, to fill it up with God's intent. And he literally did that and transformed that important part of the Jewish purification laws and religion with the very presence of God's life, with his own power, his own purpose. He said, fill them up, and he changed them into wine to bring life to the party. So hold that as maybe not the main point of this story, but an important detail that these ceremonial pots were used as Jesus revealed something about God. We're going to come back to that when we get to application. So in that case, Jesus prevented a scene of embarrassment and of shame by providing life. The very next story in the temple is quite the opposite. In this case, Jesus caused a scene. He made a scene. And this is also one of the more mysterious, it's one of the stories that raises a lot of questions for us. Because nowhere else do we see Jesus get mad and chase people, right? But something about this scene of, it was the temple, almost Passover time, he came to Jerusalem with his disciples and with all the other people of the land for Passover. And there in the temple, they were selling animals, which was part of the religion, right? You wanted to go sacrifice a variety of animals at the temple, and you wanted to have a certain kind, unblemished and right. And conveniently, they sold them there in the temple so that you could make the proper sacrifice. And had you come from out of town and needed to change your money into the currency of the land, that conveniently there were people there to help you do that. But something about that scene, which was meant to enable religious observance and faithfulness, something rubbed Jesus the wrong way. And we talked about this in confirmation too. somehow we have to balance our general thought that anger is not a godly emotion. It feels out of control. It often hurts people with, well, what do you do with a Jesus, right, who is sinless, who is God? What do you do when Jesus gets angry? How do you understand that? And he turns over the tables of the money changers, and if that weren't dramatic enough, he makes a whip out of cords and chases the animals and the rest of them out of the temple. And he says, stop, take all this away, stop making my father's house a place of business. Many an elder at Good Shepherd has been part of this conversation of, do we need to be careful what we have going on out in the gathering area on Sunday, right? Because if we sell stuff, be it brownies for the youth group or, you know, new hymn inserts or whatever it may be, do we run the risk of God coming after us, right, with whip in hand, ready to turn it over? Do we incur God's wrath and anger? The elders here have always been very diligent and careful about what goes on in God's house based on this story. Here's what the disciples thought of when they saw that. They remembered one of their scriptures, and it was a psalm. And if you're taking notes for confirmation class, this is what I mean by Robert may refer to other scriptures. Psalm 69, verse 9 says of King David, zeal for God's house will consume him. Passion, commitment, enthusiasm for God's house will consume his life. And when the disciples saw Jesus doing this, they thought of that. They thought of King David. They thought of this picture of King David as God's man who was so zealous for God's temple and house to be built. They saw Jesus and thought of King David. That's important because the Messiah was understood to be the return of a King David type, right? And they saw what Jesus did not as a guy getting angry, but as a sign he's from God. He is so zealous, so passionate about God's house that he doesn't want to see this business going on. He chased them out. The religious leaders ultimately weren't mad that he had gotten angry. They were mad that he was taking on a King David-like persona. But what I wrestle with was these folks, I can just imagine the conversation with them, especially in the early days, even being one of them, of like, well, God tells us that he commands these sacrifices in his house, and some people have to travel such a long way, and to bring, you know, their best animal for sacrifice is a hassle. And if we just made them available there in the temple, that would be a huge blessing to aid the people's worship. And certainly if they can't pay the animal handlers with the right coin, we should provide some currency exchange as well. It's all for what God commands. It has a religious purpose. And yet somehow in there, Jesus saw that, or at least what it had become, as being at odds with encountering the presence of God through the sacrificial system, through the worship that happened in the temple, and Jesus chased them out. Now again, there may be a main point in application, and I think there probably is, to religious entities of keep the main thing. Make sure that whatever it is we do, whether it's a display table outside or how the band or the choir sounds to how hot or cold it is in the room, we want to make sure that we are not presenting obstacles and distractions to the main thing of encountering God. I think that is the main idea of this story for us collectively. And that is a question our elders take very seriously, and our staff as well. We're constantly asking, are we doing anything that could distract people from the main thing? And if so, let's get it out of the way. Now, there aren't whips and cords involved in that. It's just a thoughtful, let's be thoughtful about how we lead in worship. But what I want to move to for today, seeing these two stories together, it's kind of taken me in a different direction. And this, I think, is a more personal application. And that's what I want to leave with you. I think these two stories together present two experiences of well-intentioned religious practice that we all have experienced and continue to experience. And that is this, that sometimes starting for the right reasons and with the right motivation, we engage in good and godly practices. Think of the water pots, right? God's commanded it. So we come to church, or we sing the songs, or we have our children baptized, we give to the offering, we do all these activities. But somewhere along the line, kind of like the wine at the wedding, we discover we're still doing all this stuff, and we realize that there's nothing in there anymore. Like the fire that was once in my belly for God, that passion and awareness that God is why I'm doing all this, is run out. And we're left with the motions, with the empty pots, if you were. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's reality. I've been there. I know you have been there. And what I want to hold out to you in this come and see Jesus is, Jesus didn't walk into the house and see the clay pots and say, I've come to explain Moses, to give you a better way and break the pots and let me show you I am now the what makes you clean before God. No, he took this family's ceremonial pots used for the practice of religion, and he poured himself and his power into it. And I want to offer you that as a come and see Jesus, as a picture of what God desires for us. As if you find yourself, if you're here today, you're in the right place, right? It's like you have the ceremonial pots in your house, but if you're missing the presence and the power that fills that up, that gives those reasons to be there, Jesus says, let's fill with water, with the ordinary, and I want to show up in my power and refill you once again. My application question to you, ponder today as you leave, is, are there empty wells in my life, empty pots that were, I started them for good reason, I still think they're valuable, but I'm just missing God here. And I don't have any magic formula to, I don't fill them up with wine, with the presence of God, but Jesus does. So I'd say, if the invitation is come and see Jesus, talk to him. Say, God, you know, I've been empty for a while. Will you fill me up again? Will you remind me why it is I started doing these things in the first place? Would you surprise me with not just a mediocre experience of faith and religion again, but would you fill it up with the very best, just like you did at that party? So much so that it surprises me and the folks around me with, where did this come from? You've saved this until now? It's not, no, Jesus did this. And I think just as common as that experience is of kind of finding ourselves empty is the personal application of the temple story, which is, again, perhaps for right reasons, maybe shaped by, you know, my own mess and stuff, I have let accumulate into my life, both my faith life and just my general life, clutter and stuff that gets in the way of the main thing. Right, so I talked about how our elders and how our staff, we try to declutter so that we don't block the main thing of experiencing God here. But each of us needs to do that on a personal level. I have to do that on a personal level. I shared with the confirmation class, I mean, one small detail of that for me, and I messed up last night, was I got to go to bed at a reasonable hour so that I am present and on and ready to encounter God, and I'm not distracted by sleepiness or tiredness. Now, in my defense, last night I went to bed at a really reasonable hour. It was like 9:30, right? But I told the grill master, Buckman, this morning, I closed my eyes ready for a good, you know, pre-Sunday night sleep. And all of a sudden, I felt this, I've got to go climb a mountain or something. I've got to, you know, run a marathon. It's because I'd gone to his house and he had grilled this amazing meat that he had hunted, and I ate way too much of it. And I have not had that much protein in the last year combined, right? All this, and I got in bed, my body was like, okay, you just fed us, let's go do the thing, right? And all night long, I was just sitting there like, what am I going to do? What am I going to have all this protein and energy? It's a good decision, bad timing. Multiply that out to all kinds of things, right? Patterns, habits, addictions we engage in, TV shows, computer games, phone stuff that occupies so much of our time. Our own, you know, frustrations and discouragement and just being buried by the discouragement, the anxiety. I mean, it's a whole range of human stuff becomes like so many tables of marketplace and money changers and stuff just filling up God's house, so that even on a Sunday morning when we've said, I'm going to go worship God, we get here And there's like this, our own personal room full of stuff between us and God. I don't think Jesus wants to whip you. I think it's a great metaphor for the energy and passion that it takes to clear stuff out of my own life, right? I can't just say, it'll be better tomorrow. I mean, the stuff that I let accumulate in my life, it takes a real confrontation and clearing it out of the way, and sometimes asking for help if I'm going to clear a space to say, God, help me, meet me here. But I think about these two stories side by side in John chapter 2, right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. And I couldn't help but think of my own life. There are times when I feel empty and I need Jesus to show up and fill me up. And there are times when I've tried to fill up and it's cluttered and I need Jesus' help to clear it away. And in both cases, it's to do what John tells us in chapter 1 that he came to do, which is to show us God, to explain God, to show us the life and the light and the word that is God. I think these two stories are a great lived out example of come and see. Come and check me out. Whether you feel empty or whether you feel buried by the clutter, by the obstacles, by all that hinders you, Jesus says, meet me here. Ask me in. Ask for help. That's what I desire and delight to do for you. And in the the joy that is preparing a heartfelt sermon every week, I had to deal with my own stuff all over again. That's like the downside of preaching, right? That I have to, it's like, okay, Robert, you got all this clutter. You have empty spots where you have tried to fill it. You're the preacher, man. Ask God for help. And that's God's invitation to you as well this morning. So may God cause that word to take root, to draw us, to invite us, to bear fruit in our life. Amen.